at the Association of Greek Workers of Quebec at 5359 Park Avenue in Montreal. There is a Hamilton component to it. People are going to be carpooling from Hamilton to take part in the summit. You can register to be there in person, or you can register for the Zoom live stream. For in-person registration, visit tinyurl.com/stopnato. Or you can register for the Zoom live stream at tinyurl.com/stopnato-zoom. That's tinyurl.com/stopnato-zoom. So check out the Instagram for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War at Hamilton_HCSW. It's also listed in the blog items of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website at hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca. The other event we wanted you to know about, and this one is closer to home, is the F-35 Day of Action at Clapisson's Corners. That's the intersection of Highway 5 and Clapisson Avenue. That's going to be November 16th, this Saturday, 10 a.m., L3 Harris Waterdown, L3 Harris being the company involved. By targeting Canadian manufacturers involved in the F-35 supply chain, the organizers are making Canada's complicity in Israel's violence undeniable, pushing back on government lies and demanding government action to ensure that the flow of arms to Israel be cut off. And to tell us more about that, I have an interview recorded last night with Angeline Delaurier from Labour for Palestine Hamilton about the national campaign for Arms Embargo Now, F-35 Day of Action, that's also taking place in Hamilton. So let's go over to that now.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial. And now I'm with Angeline Delaurier, and she is with Labour for Palestine. So Angeline, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Well, Labour for Palestine is something that is a welcome sight in Hamilton. I know there are chapters in other cities, and now the District Labour Council, the Solidarity Place seem to be involved with this. I guess the first question for our listeners who might not be familiar is, what is Labour for Palestine in general as the national group that you're part of?
Yeah, so like you said, it's national. It's a network across Canada of labour activists who stand in solidarity with Palestinians and specifically Palestinian workers and all people there who are struggling.
Now, the Hamilton branch is something that's relatively new. I've heard about it in the last few months and managed to come to a couple of meetings. I guess, how did you come to be involved in the Hamilton branch, in fact, in setting it up? What took place there? How did you get that going?
Yeah, so I live and work in Hamilton, but my office is actually in Toronto. I'm a public servant, so I'm a member of AMAPCIO, and I was involved with the GTA chapter of Labour for Palestine, and one of the National Steering Committee members asked if we could help get a chapter set up for Hamilton. This is, you know, a city with a long history of labor activism, so it made sense. And there were already a number of us in the GTA chapter who were actually Hamiltonians. So yeah, we had our inaugural meeting in August and have participated in the Labor Day parade and a few more activities. And the National Steering Committee is also looking at, more actions that we can take in solidarity with Palestinian workers and using our labor role, just like it was done in the case of Justice for South Africa in the late 80s, early 90s, to use our labor to put pressure on government to make changes in how it deals with Israel, who is, an apartheid state and committing genocide against the Palestinians.
this program you mentioned with labor and stoppage of cargo, is it related to the National Arms Embargo Now campaign?
Well, we are part of the Arms Embargo Now coalition. And yes, coming up this weekend is the National Day of Action for the F-35 airplane or aircraft. I'll probably make mistakes in how I refer to it because I'm not a military equipment nerd, but there are a lot of companies in Canada that are profiting off the death and destruction in Palestine. And yeah, we want to bring awareness to that and how this isn't just a fight that's happening over there and that Canadians aren't involved. Canadians are involved in many different ways. We are complicit in many different ways. And we have companies that are producing parts or equipment for the Israeli army and profiting off that right here in Hamilton and all across Canada.
Yeah, there's going to be this action that you're taking part in on November 16, I believe. I wanted to talk a bit about the context of that. About a week ago, I suppose, I was at a Zoom meeting, I think on Monday. It was a large meeting, a national level meeting of Labor for Palestine and World Beyond War and other groups. Were you at that meeting?
Yeah, the webinar was put on by, I think it was Just Peace or, World Beyond War. That's right. You named a few of the organizations. I think it's all under the umbrella of Arms Embargo Now, the Canadian organization. Yeah, it was a great webinar.
That was a very large meeting. I counted about 358 people in attendance. So, yeah, there is a national level campaign, and it's my understanding that they do want to bring attention to military production that's going to Israel across Canada, and they identified a number of sites. So it looks like this upcoming action in Hamilton, you've identified a site that's involved with Israeli military production. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we don't have confirmation that the parts manufactured at that location are going into the F-35, but L3Harris, the company in Waterdown, is one of the companies that supplies parts for the F-35 and creates and manufactures parts for all kinds of other weapons like drones and, other targeting systems. But specifically, yes, they contribute parts to the F-35. And what I remember from the webinar last week is that every F-35 includes $3 million worth of parts from Canadian manufacturers. And, understanding how each one of these aircraft is probably $1 billion, $3 million doesn't seem like a lot, but every single one of those parts is essential to the completion of these aircraft. And so any disruption in that supply chain can delay the delivery of these war machines to Israel.
Well, people want to do things to impact Israel, to show that they are not supporting Canada's policy of letting money and supplies go to Israel. So what specifically are you hoping to achieve with the action at this plant? There's going to be a couple actions, right? First of all, there's going to be people that are creating a blockage, but also there's an informational picket. Could you elaborate on that?
What our intent is to bring attention, bring awareness to Hamilton and to the neighborhood around this factory, to the fact that these weapons are being made and manufactured right in our backyard. This L3Harris facility in Waterdown is right next to Walmart, Canadian Tire, Rona. So, it's just part of the background fabric of the suburbs, but people don't know that that company there is making profits off the death and destruction of Palestinians and Palestinian land.
It sounds to me as if there should be a strong consensus behind this, given the level of support for Palestine in our community. Who is going to be part of this local Hamilton area action, or what groups are involved in sponsoring or promoting it?
Right. So Labor for Palestine Hamilton and Mamas for Palestine, which is a local organization in Halton and Hamilton area that brings awareness to the Palestinian struggle in our area, and especially likes to make family-friendly events in support of Palestine and supporting the resettlement of Gazan families in the area. But we also have support from the Hamilton West Ancaster Dundas for Palestine, Hamilton for Palestine, Independent Jewish Voices Hamilton, and many other organizations in the area.
Well, that's very good. And I imagine a campaign for Palestine and having Labor for Palestine would involve lots of different kind of strategies and events. Looking forward, do you have an idea, perhaps, of what kind of future actions Labor for Palestine might want to carry out after this?
Well, because we work, through labor, there's a lot of, bringing resolutions to conventions, and those usually revolve around divestment. A lot of the membership of Labor for Palestine comes from public sector unions, so one of the, the main items that we would like to address is to look at the investments of our pension funds and where they're invested in any kind of company that profits from the war efforts of Israel, that we divest from them. And this is good not just for in the sense of divesting from the war in Israel, but also any other kind of abuses that are undertaken with military equipment. So we don't want any of our pension funds or any of our union funds going to that.
Yes, with the campaigns like the one against the JNF, for example, how important it is to look at the fundraising for Israel, and if tax dollars are involved, if subsidies are involved, if Canada is allowing money to go over and your money to be spent and so on. So I think those are valuable activities.
Exactly. And so we're taking the concept of hot cargo broadly. And the concept of hot cargo was based on some unions, and I'm not going to remember exactly, but I know that in the past unions, especially, dock workers, have blocked the transfer and transportation of hot cargo, so cargo that included weapons going to regimes that are committing war crimes. They would stop the transfer of those. So we are taking that more broadly to look at any kind of economic activity with Israel. So whether that exchanges of technology or, agreements between different universities or research between different levels of government and their government. And so identifying all of those economic and social connections and using our labor power to disrupt that.
Yes, that all sounds very good. And I understand the issue of labor power, what organized workers can do, was a major theme at the national level meeting of Labor for Palestine and the other groups last week. So if people want to get involved in the upcoming action on the 16th, what can they look at on social media or the internet to get the details? What are the details and where can people look that up?
Yeah, so if they go to armsembargonow.ca/F35, they'll find information about the National Day of Action, as well as a map that shows where each of the actions is occurring and the information for each of the actions. So for us, for the Hamilton action, we are meeting at the intersection of Highway 5 and Clapison Avenue in Waterdown at 10 a.m. And so we will have an information picket there. We'll share information with passersby, and then rally and walk over to L3 Harris, which is just a short walk away.
And if somebody wants to get involved in Labor for Palestine, will you have a social media or gathering place that people can start to get involved?
Yeah, so it's Labor for Palestine. So it's LaborForPalestine, Palestine. So no numbers in there, .com. And yeah, you just have to go there and click join, and they'll connect you with us.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, yeah, people should get on the email list and then you should get involved. So I know you've got a lot of organizing to do this week, but I wanted to thank you for being on the program. And we hope that this is a very good upcoming action in a few days.
Thank you, Brendan. Yeah, happy to welcome anybody who wants to support us on Saturday morning.
And that was Anjaloon from Labor for Palestine Hamilton. Thank you, Anjaloon. I wanted to give more detail about the upcoming events, specifically the Counter NATO Summit on the 23rd, 24th. So I'll lay out to you what's going on. NATO is coming to town, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Not this town, but Montreal on Sunday, November 24th. At least that's when there's going to be a counter summit against NATO's Parliamentary Assembly. It's no to NATO, yes to peace. And this counter summit, which is like a session or sessions of teach-ins, speeches, lectures, is going to take place Sunday, November 24th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Association of Greek Workers of Quebec at 5359 Park Avenue in Montreal. Since 1990, NATO has left a trail of death and destruction with interventions in former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Libya, and now Ukraine. These interventions have led to failed states, environmental damage, violence against women, and humanity's largest refugee crisis. NATO allies have also wasted trillions of dollars on wars and weapons that have enriched the arms industry and exacerbated conflict around the world. You can take part in the counter summit, and you can register via Eventbrite. The tickets are $20 for general admission or $10 for student and unwaged. There is a Hamilton component to it. People are going to be carpooling from Hamilton to take part in the summit. You can register to be there in person, or you can register for the Zoom live stream. For in-person registration, visit tinyurl, that's tinyurl.com/stopNATO. That's capital S, small case T-O-P, capital NATO. Or you can register for the Zoom live stream at tinyurl.com/stopNATO-Zoom. That's tinyurl.com/stopNATO-Zoom. Speakers will include Medea Benjamin, the U.S.-based author, activist, and co-founder of Code Pink, and Sevig Dagdelen, the author and member of the German Bundestag, and a full day of prominent speakers and discussion against NATO. And you can join the rally demanding Canada out of NATO on Saturday, November 23rd at Place de Canada at 2 p.m., organized by the Mouvement Québécois pour un Pays, or MQP. So check out the Instagram for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War at Hamilton_HCSW. It's also listed in the blog items of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website at hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca. The other event we wanted you to know about, and this one is closer to home, is the F-35 Day of Action at Clapeyson's Corners. That's the intersection of Highway 5 and Clapeyson Avenue. That's going to be November 16th, this Saturday, 10 a.m., L3 Harris Waterdown, L3 Harris being the company involved. By targeting Canadian manufacturers involved in the F-35 supply chain, the organizers are making Canada's complicity in Israel's violence undeniable, pushing back on government lies and demanding government action to ensure that the flow of arms to Israel be cut off. So be sure to look it up, HamiltonCoalitionToStopTheWar.ca and on Instagram, Hamilton_HCSW. For the rest of today's program, we have this Monday's Taylor Report. Suitably on Remembrance Day, the episode is about what to remember on Remembrance Day. And it's an interview with Peter McFarlane, the author of Family Ties, which investigates the history of Chrystia Freeland's grandfather in World War II Ukraine. So they have a lot to talk about history, the Canadian Parliament, Remembrance Day in Canada. So let's go over to that now.
And we're back. It is the Taylor Report. And we were welcoming a the author of a wonderful book. It's called Family Ties. It's the subtitle is How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. It's published by Lorimer. I think it's probably one of the most important books of the of our time, because it is, it paints a big canvas explaining how people who collaborated and loyally served Hitler ended up in Canada and became kind of a political force, and bringing with them an individual covered in this book, Michael Chomiak, who famously is the grandfather of our current deputy prime minister. And we've spoken to Peter before, but we thought the occasion of Remembrance Day would be the time to really resume our discussion. Are you there, Peter?
Yes, I am, yeah.
It's very, boy, it's good to be talking to you, because we're being, you know, today's the day. The Globe says, lest we forget. And the big title of the day is Remembrance. I guess it used to be Armistice. I don't know why they changed their mind about what to call it. But as you've pointed out, Canada has a memory problem. And your book points to a big, several places where we don't seem to remember. And I guess we should just, the way to illustrate is that Parliament didn't seem to know who had fought in World War II and applauded Mr. Humke, who was identified after the applause as a Ukrainian Nazi collaborator. so, I mean, I want to frame it maybe this way. Since they are talking about remembrance, we had the war, and they're not reminding us, the World War I was called the war to end all wars. But it seemed to have, everybody agrees now, led to a bad peace that created World War II. And in the interim, in Ukraine, in the part of the world from where Mr. Chomiak is from, wild things began to occur. So could you talk about that? Is it true? I mean, that, have I got it right that the sort of the birthing of the modern fascist movement in Western Ukraine occurred in that period?
Yeah, that's right. I guess it was the organization of Ukrainian Nationalists was founded, I think, in 1929, and they were kind of they were aligned with the right-wing fascist movement across Europe at the time. And especially after 1933, when the Nazis came in power in Berlin, they were closely aligned with the Nazi German government, and they received funding from them and that sort of thing. And their sort of their ideological guides were publishing biographies of Hitler and Mussolini and that sort of thing. So it was a fascist organization during the 30s, like many in Europe. Especially Eastern Europe during the time, that the armed wing of the organization of Ukrainian Nationalists was called the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. That was founded in 1942, mm-hmm. and of course the leader was the Bandera, Stepan Bandera, and the military leader was Roman Shukovich. And you'll find today in Ukrainian Nationalists, these are still the heroes of the movement today, the ethno-nationalist movement in Ukraine, which is kind of dominant in the government of Ukraine these days.
Mm-hmm. That period of creation, and incidentally, you mentioned, of course, Hitler, and when it was fascists came to power, 34, I guess, the Mussolini was already in power, and I notice in your book you point out that some of the people who became the leaders of, convenience, I call them fascists, began to, they were taken with Mussolini. There was a kind of romance of him too, but it's almost like they had two heroes, right? They started with Mussolini, then some of the camp moved over to emulating the Nazis in Germany. And Well, I guess I want to throw in an idea. I noticed also in your book, I believe you document this, these people were interested in eugenics. That is, they had the idea of racial supremacy was very alive as a discussion point amongst these political movements, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And for the Ukrainians, Ukrainian national-nationalists, they were actually aligned with the fascists, so it's not a big stretch to call them fascists. They were very much influenced by the kind of eugenics idea of the Nazis, and they promoted within Ukraine the idea that Ukraine had to be free of foreign influences, that Polish, Jewish, and Russian citizens within Ukraine. And their goal was to obtain like a pure Ukrainian race by getting rid of the other racial groups. And their main, I guess, racial theorist was called Yuri Lupa. He was a doctor, and he was part of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And he put the Ukrainians on the racial scale as second only to the Nordics. It's interesting he put the Germans first, but he put the Ukrainians second in the racial scale of humanity. And he's particularly interested.
They were Aryan wannabes.
Yeah. The next level, yeah. And it's kind of interesting because in exile in Krakow, where the nationalists ended up in Nazi Krakow when they left Ukraine, they were given identity cards that were second. They put them at the second level, actually. They were ahead of the Poles and, of course, ahead of the Jews and just under the Germans and had special privileges that other groups didn't have. So they were kind of recognized as being the number two group in the human racial scale. Mm-hmm. And Lupa is really interesting because he was extreme eugenicist. He would say things like that the 300 eggs of every Ukrainian woman are sort of the identical treasure, for example, like energy resources, iron, coal, and petroleum. So he saw that racial a part of Ukraine as an essential part of the country, and it was unthinkable that it would be other races that would have any rights within Ukraine. And today in Toronto, the language school, the Ukrainian language school, it's called the Yuri Lupa Ukrainian language school. So he's still a hero in among ethno-nationalist Ukrainians in Canada today.
And of course, it's being energetically promoted in contemporary Ukraine, where I don't know why it's denied here or it's played down, because they have parades at night with torches and they talk about foreigners out, Poles, Jews. They openly do this.
Right.
And they're still they're pursuing the old idea of some special racial supremacy. And I want to ask you about that directly in the use of this flag, which we see it now on the streets once in a while. And we saw very famously Chrystia Freeland at a demonstration at Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto.
Right.
She's had her hand on a black and red flag. So what is that flag? Where is her origin? What does that stand for?
Okay, that came through in the late 30s and the early 40s as well. Today, the Ukrainian nationalists will say it's the red and black flag, it's the blood and soil flag, and what it means that Ukrainian blood is spilled on Ukrainian black earth. But in fact, it was adopted by the Ukrainian Surgeon Army in 1942.
And 1942?
It was drawn directly from the blood and soil slogan of the Nazis, which was one of their most popular slogans at the time. That's how they justified their sort of ethnic purity of their territory as well. So the blood and soil meant that you could only be a German by blood. So that excluded, of course, all minorities. Particularly, it was used against Jews. And the land belonged to that blood group, and so no other people could inhabit that land that was theirs. And so that was then the flag that was adopted by the Ukrainian Surgeon Army, because that was also their position for Ukraine.
Yeah. The term, I think when people repeat it to themselves, they begin to hear the echo, and they're reminding us, of course, it's remembrance, so we're supposed to remember. So the Germans, then under Nazi leadership, had this idea And they worked very hard at it. Science, they had scientists and they had research and trying to work out this thing. And it was blood and soil. And that was, you found this also, did you not, in Romania, Bulgaria, what used to be Yugoslavia, there were people, they took up this idea, trying to work out by blood who they were, right?
That was a widely used sort of fascist image, was the blood soil, and it was used, of course, to support their ethnic group and make sure that other ethnic groups had no rights within their territory, their soil. It was only the people of that blood would have rights to that land.
And by the way, we sort of, I mean, everybody said, oh, how could they have gone so far down that road and been so mean, cruel, and insistent on blood, et cetera. But in the United States at that time, they had legal segregation, and they were counting blood samples in the South. If you had, what was it, 1/8, you were... You couldn't go to a white school, et cetera. The environment, I mean, and also, by the way, eugenics was very strong in the United States.
And in Canada, too, as well, It was part of the elite and often even liberal. Canadians believed that it was important to protect the blood of the it's the fundamental doctrine, I guess, of white supremacy and the idea that there's a blood group that is superior to the others, which is, you know, kind of also the heart of fascism. But it was certainly widespread in the Western world.
Yeah, I recall I had family members who, by the way, who are regarded today as people to remember. We had a brave sailor in our neighborhood, and everybody talked about him because he had been in a plane that was shot down not just once but twice. So everybody took their hat off when they met him. So I asked my mother once, what did he think of Germany before the war? She said, oh, he loved Hitler. People, you know, when we honor people, you want to be very be careful. And it's Americans have to face, and by the way, I want to tie that in with your story about family ties. The Americans were very, almost ambivalent about Nazi Germany for quite a long time. It shouldn't be surprising to us, should it, that after the war, some of these old, ugly things began to reappear and be accepted.
Right, for sure.
You have a nice description, and again, we're talking to Peter McFarland. The book is Family Ties. You discuss and really explain how it came up to pass that people like Michael Chomiak, who was a Nazi collaborator, and the members of the SS Galician came into Canada. That was a policy set from Washington, was it not?
The welcoming of the SS men into Canada in 1948, that was actually from the British. We were affiliated closely with the British. Of course, our war effort, we were part of the British military mm-hmm. structure. And it was the British that finally signaled that they were going to welcome the SS men, and they wouldn't do any serious vetting them at the border. They would just bring them in. And it was a Canadian in Europe at the time, a Ukrainian-Canadian officer, who gave the Ukrainian SS people Red Cross cards that sort of made it a little bit easier to let them out of the country and into Canada. It was mainly a British initiative for Canada, but the Americans were doing it as well.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to be sure I asked you that we have a quite... outstanding Canadian journalist Puglisi in Ottawa Citizen. He has looked into the case of the 900 Nazis / collaborators. I don't know which is equally bad, whatever. And the question is, are we going to publish the names? And apparently, once again, they've decided, no, they won't. I don't know any party in Canada that's actually demanding that they publish. Maybe there is. But why shouldn't we be asking, why don't we have the names of the people who let them in?
That's right. Yeah. We have. We probably do have them in the names. I don't know who the foreign affairs minister was at the time. I don't recall that. They were sort of, as I said earlier, they were sort of swept in without individual accountability. Even though at the time they had word that I think the Soviets at the time had a list of several hundred of them that were charged with war crimes. And certainly there were lots of war criminals within them because they were part of the SS on one purely technical ground at the Nuremberg tribunal determined that just membership in the SS was a criminal act. It was a criminal organization, and to be a member was a criminal act.
Yes.
Especially because the SS was a volunteer organization. Nobody was forced to serve in the SS. It was purely volunteer, and the Ukrainian Galician SS was no exception. They volunteered to be part of that organization, and as such, they were all criminals in that sense. And those accused of specific crimes, there was no investigation, really, in Canada. The list of 900 comes from the Duchesne Commission in 1980 that looked at the question of Eastern European, mainly, I think, Ukrainian war criminals in Canada. And they published a very watered-down report, very evasive, on the question of the fact that they let the SS people into Canada, the idea that they should be expelled because SS weren't allowed to be in Canada. They used the excuse that we couldn't expel them because we knew they were SS when we let them in. So they were in Canada legally, even though technically they should never have been allowed to be in. But the list of the 900 names comes from the Duchesne Commission that hid the facts and would not release the facts at the time in the 1980s. And since then, a lot of Jewish organizations and human rights organizations have been fighting to get that list released. It seemed that they were going to be released a few months ago. The Ukrainian nationalist groups in Canada went to court to try and block the release. And then, of course, huge pressure was put on the Canadian government. And, of course, the Canadian government, the deputy prime minister, there would be a lot of family friends on that list. So I think it was not surprising that Canada will once again suppress the truth on those.
It's rather interesting, isn't it? I mean, politics trumps law.
Yes. Yes. And more and more these days it seems that way. And surprisingly, yes, that does. Yeah.
Very unpleasant business. We're speaking to Peter McFarlane. The title of the book is Family Ties. Everybody should have a copy of this book. Lorimer, bless their hearts, published it. And it follows the Chomiak family. By the way, Peter went to Ukraine, has been there quite recently, actually. I wanted to ask you about this. I wanted to clarify that, and I thank you very much on the red and black issue, the blood and soil. And then there's a slogan, and once in a while the prime minister actually says it. Sometimes he doesn't. It seems to depend on the heat under the, how much fire is under the pot. But when they really seem to be in a crisis, various Canadian leaders say, Slava Ukraina. What the heck are they saying? Where's that from?
Yeah, it's Slava Ukraina. That's basically glory to Ukraine. And the response by Ukrainians is generally glory to the heroes. And glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes. And it became widespread. Really, in the organization of Ukrainian nationalists during its certainly undeniably fascist period in the 1930s and 40s. It was kind of an equivalent of Heil Hitler. You would just, when you greeted somebody, you would say, Slava Ukraini, just in the same way that Germans would say Heil Hitler. So it was very much a fascist slogan, of course. And it was also, of course, it was discouraged and impossible to use during after the Soviet Union reasserted itself. But it remained in Canada and other places with the diaspora groups. In Canada, you would hear, Slava Ukraini at the meetings of the sort of the Bandera-aligned groups that were flourishing in Canada under the protection and support, really, of the Canadian government. The problem is that it does have echoes still of the sort of the fascist slogan and the response of glory to the heroes. The heroes that they're celebrating are really the fascist heroes of the past. Again, Bandera and Trukovic, and there's scores of others, great heroes in ethno-nationalist Ukraine who were affiliated with the Nazis, the Nazi collaborators.
Mm-hmm. So there's no real ambivalence about it, what its origins and what is it was intended. And the personality that we tend to say here, know of the name of, because there's so much heat around his name, is Mr. Bandera. Was that his? That was his movement that had that originated. That's the Slava Ukraine.
Yes, it was. Yeah, the organization of Ukrainian nationalists, as I mentioned, was founded in 1929, and I think it was in 1939 or 38. The leader of that organization was assassinated, I think, by a Soviet agent, I believe. And the organization split into two groups, the Melnik group and the Bandera group. And they took kind of different tactics on dealing with the 1940s. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists had their own armed insurgency that they were active on the ground inside Ukraine. And the other group, the Melnik group, because I know it's maybe too much history, but the Melnik group was the one that supported the creation of the SS. And Freeland's grandfather was part of that that group. And so they kept very good relations with the Nazis, and they sort of co-authored the creation of the SS, the Ukrainian SS.
And, of course, Mr. Chomiak, who we're talking about, of course, is the focus of the book, Michael Chomiak. In terms of these two heroes I hear about, one is Shukevich.
Yep.
He was killed, was it in combat? And then Bandera was assassinated in Berlin, right? Do you know what Chomiak's view of the two individuals was? Did he have a favorite, or was he consider it one phenomenon?
Yeah, he was considered to be part of the Melnik branch. He went into Krakow. Krakow was the capital of the Nazi government in Poland, and he ran the newspaper, a newspaper supported by German intelligence in Ukrainian language, that was there to support the Nazi war effort. And it was full of course, the anti-Semitic articles and a pretty nasty piece of work. And he edited that newspaper for 5 years, from I think 1940 to 1945. His group and the people in Krakow tended to be with the Melnik group that were then, they wanted to work more closely with the German authorities and create the SS and that sort of thing. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, they had their own insurgent army after 1942, and they fought the Soviets, and they had skirmishes with the Nazis as well during that period.
And your book is so helpful. You point out in the book, or mention, that Mikhail Chomiak, he was born under the Austrians. It was the, I forget what the name of the emperor was, but he spoke impeccable German.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. It's part of the complications today for people to understand that what's happening in Ukraine, because Ukraine was the whole part of eastern part of Ukraine, well, two-thirds of the Ukraine, was first part of the Russian Empire, and then it was part of the Soviet Union. But there was another, the western part of Ukraine that was known as Galicia, was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire up until the end of the First World War. And then it was a part of Poland until 1939. And then after the war, then it was reintegrated into the greater Ukraine. Chomiak was born in 1905, and he went to school, and, you know, just before the First World War, and the you know, the picture on the wall of the school would have been of Franz Joseph. The language of the school would have been German at the time. Huh. The Ukrainians were a majority in that region, but it was run as a province of the Hungarian Austrian-Hungarian Empire. So his German, he was quite at home in the German language, as were all the Ukrainians from Western Ukraine, which partly explains why they were so easily drawn into the German orbit. They saw themselves, at least when they were younger, as they were citizens of
the
Austrian-Hungarian
Empire. German ambitions.
Yes, that's right. And they had German sort of ideologies.
Yeah. And the other personality that shapes your book is Anne Charney, who the author of Dobried, terrific, pardon me?
Yes, yeah.
A wonderful book. She's born in the same, roughly, you know, not far from Mr. Shomiak, except she's born under Polish authority, right?
That's right, yes. Yeah, he was still part of, after the Second World War, I think it was official in around 1921, that whole area of Western Ukraine came under the control of Poland. And so he, when he was, I guess, in his 20s, he became a Polish citizen. I think I mentioned in the book that they became part of three different countries without ever moving. They were part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. They were part of then Poland. And then, of course, after the Second War, they were part of the Soviet Union, and they could live in the same spot. And these countries sort of washed over you.
You know,
go ahead.
I just want to ask you this. And this is, again, the book Family Ties, Peter McFarlane is very so helpful on this. When they had this Maidan, I call it a coup, because there never was a proper election as they had agreed to, etc., the man that they removed as president, he led a party called the Party of Regions.
Right.
And when I look at it on a map and know something about the East and West Ukraine, if you want to run the country, you better be the Party of Regions. I mean, that's a healthy concept because we do rather recklessly, and I'm guilty of it all the time, using the word Ukraine when there's a clear division of opinion among those people we call Ukrainians from East to West. And actually, I'm curious if you know this, the majority of people that come on, if you do it by territory, the majority actually are Eastern or consider themselves part of the Russian system historically. Am I right?
That's right. Well, they saw themselves as brother nations with Russia for many years up till quite recently. It's kind of, if you look at the electoral map of Ukraine going back from 1991 when it broke away from the Soviet Union broke up, you'll see that 90% of the people in the eastern Ukraine vote for one party, and the Party of Regions type of party with the inclusive party, and 90% in the western Ukraine, mainly around Lviv, vote for the sharp sort of ethnic nationalist party.
The Bandera people.
In the middle, there's a kind of a distribution between the two. But the winning elections, it tended to be the winning party, it tended to be the Party of Regions. It was only one example of the nationalist party won after a disputed election, I think in 2003, and then came what you rightly called the coup in 2014.
So it's really crucial to understand what's going on there now. And in your book, I think you point out Zelensky came into power promising peace and an agreement with Russia. He said specifically with Russia, he could make a deal with Russia.
Yes.
And so when they voted, he did very well, except in the area around Lvov.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, he actually got 73% of the vote in the presidential election. The only region that voted against him was, again, that area around Lviv or Lvov. And that's where the heart of the ethno-nationalists are. And so after he got elected, I think during the campaign, he said he would do a deal with the devil just to avoid war. That what he was going to do was avoid war with Russia. and he was going to agree to, there was already an accord on the table, an accord that both the Ukrainian government and the West had sponsored, and Russia as well. And he was going to sign the protocols for that accord. When he was elected, after less than a couple of weeks, there were demonstrations called No Capitulation against the Russians. They threatened clearly many times they would kill him if he signed the accord. And at the time, the eco-nationalists already had their own military brigade in the army, in the Ukrainian army. They had their own, the Azov battalion. They had tanks, et cetera. And so they really could have, put the tanks on a street in Kiev and caused certainly a civil war, if not an outright takeover of the government. So he did then back away from that. And at the same time, it was the exact same time that the Biden administration was coming into power. And their idea, of course, was that they would arm Ukraine to fight Russia, to weaken Russia. And they had they believed they could get rid of Putin very quickly. They would collapse the Russian economy with the sanctions. And of course, we see that didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm. To show how badly the situation has become, I know that you've called attention to the fact that here we have people came to Canada. They weren't brought in, called SS. They were brought in, it's a scandal which is never going to go away, apparently. But part of the scandal is that what you call the Edmonton Fortress, that is a stronghold of the most of the, I would call them, Western Ukrainian elements. They now want to be treated like veterans of World War II, yeah, along with those that we're all taking our hats off for today. What about that?
Yeah, no, that's one of the more bizarre episodes, I think. I think maybe back up a little bit on Ukrainians and the war. About 200,000 Ukrainians during the Second World War participated in some form or other, along with the Nazi collaborators. But at the same time, in Soviet Ukraine, 7 million Ukrainian soldiers fought in the Red Army, made an enormous contribution to the liberation of Ukraine and the rest of Eastern Europe. And
they went all the way to Berlin.
They went all the way to Berlin, and they were some of the finest fighting troops, and they had enormous losses fighting against the Hitler forces, but also the forces of Bandera. They were certainly engaged in battles through Galicia, and they fought with the SS against the Ukrainian SS in and around Brody, where Anne Charney is from. So they were. It was overwhelmed. We tend to talk a lot about the Ukrainians. We'll talk about the Bandera and the ethnic nationalists and that sort of thing. But the great majority of Ukrainians were in the Red Army, and they were fighting on our side in the war with the Allies. There's no question. And the same thing is within Canada.
Yeah.
That they brought 2,000 SS men in 1948. But during the war, there were 40,000 Canadian Ukrainian who fought with the Canadian Army, so obviously with the Allies, who were, by extension, with the Soviet Union, who were allied with as well. So it was the great majority of Ukrainians were on the side of our side, the Allies. And these are small groups that are very active. And for reasons during the Cold War, they were given control of the Ukrainian organization. So we tend to speak of the Ukrainians as Nazi collaborators and that sort of thing. But we have to always remember that was a small minority that was of Ukraine that had a big influence. And Canada, that our politicians tend to listen only to that group, the ethno-nationalist group that came, born out of the fascist groups of the 1930s. And we tend to look at them as the representatives of Ukraine. Well, we really should not. The 40,000 Ukrainians fought for Canada. And on Remembrance Day, we should certainly remember them and their efforts. And I think he also mentioned about the nationalists. I think you're referring to in the book where I mentioned that Paul Grode, who was a good friend of the family of Freeland and the Tromyak gang, he was the head of the Ukrainian Canadian Committee in during the, I think, 2010 at least, and now he's the head of the International Committee for the Ukrainian lobby group. And he wrote a letter in 2010 to the government, an official letter, demanding that the veterans in Canada of the Organization of the Ukrainian Nationals and the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, the Bandera group, you know, who were responsible collectively for the murder of tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of Jews and Poles during the 40s, that they be recognized as Canadian veterans, and they be given better pensions and that sort of thing by the Canadian government. And it's, I think it's a good example of how out of touch, really, the Ukrainian nationalist or ethno-nationalist cult is in Canada and internationally.
Well, it's a shock. As you point out, actually, the more one thinks about it in the backdrop you've provided, this is a small group. It's never reflected what it's you call, we now call that Ukraine. They were just one region, and they were a drop in the water, ocean, compared to the Ukrainians who fought Hitler.
Right.
This is a rump group, and I, you know, it strikes me that clearly if they swore allegiance, and they did, to Adolf Hitler himself,
right,
they're traitors to Ukraine. And kind of more importantly, or as important, they're traitors to the Allied struggle against Hitler, which cost of too many lives, 20, 25, and the numbers just are staggering when you think about it, how many people right. lost their lives. But always this group was never the representative of the Ukrainian people.
No, absolutely not. In 2010, when Grote was writing that letter to the Canadian government asking that they be included as Canadian veterans, those same groups and Bandera, et cetera, by the European Union were considered and denounced as fascist groups, and the succeeding groups of the OUN and UKIP, as they call the insurgents, they were also condemned completely by the European Union. That's as late as 2010. But it changed when, I think, 2014, with the coup, but already the Americans were deeply involved in the coup. We know that Newland was, she's famously on a tape picking the government of the coup government that was broadcast. You can find it on the internet now. So the Americans were deeply involved in that because they had decided they would make Ukraine part of NATO, and that was in 2008. So since then, there's been kind of an underground war for the heart and soul of Ukrainians, and the Americans put in, I think it was $5 billion they put in by 2014 in trying to influence.
Destroy the country.
Yeah. And again, in 2008, when it was NATO announced they would invite Ukraine in, a poll at the time showed that 45% of Ukrainians actually saw NATO as an enemy of Ukraine, and only 15% thought NATO was a friend of Ukraine. So they worked very hard to convince Ukrainians to try to pull Ukraine, as they would say, from the Russian orbit. That culminated in 2014 with the coup. And after that, there was an alliance between, you know, the right-wing nationalists and the Western powers who were trying to influence events in Ukraine.
It's so great you're talking about it, but we'll just remind listeners, the reason we talk about Chrystia Freeland is she had a grandfather who was a Nazi collaborator, and the issue with her is she has never addressed the point. Nobody's angry with her. She wasn't in the war. But she doesn't say who her grandfather she loved, who he actually was. That's our problem, right?
Right, that's right. Exactly, yeah.
Peter McFarland, man, you got a great book, Family Ties, Lorimer. And and you have a Twitter. I think people should follow you. Peter McFar, at Peter McFar.
And that's our program for this week. So thanks for listening. And until next week. Take care.
Before we start with our program, here is a community event you might want to check out. DVSA Artist Talk, Chris Perez, November 15th, 1 p.m. in Dundas Valley School of Art. Chris is a Hamilton-based Filipino artist practicing in abstract painting and